Welcome, readers. I'm Elaine Charles, host of The Book Report and tour guide for our weekly sojourn among the new, the fascinating, and the funny in our beloved world of books. Okay, the holiday season is just a fond memory. It's back to work for all of us. Nose to the grindstone, eye on the prize. So, the bottom line is, I think this might be the perfect time to delve into a category of titles we've rarely touched upon, business books. The category is full to brimming, and many titles are absolutely spellbinding. Don't touch that dial. I'm not going to bore you with flowcharts, P&Ls, and PowerPoints. Instead, I believe I picked some titles that will really grab your interest. So, let's get this meeting started.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. M-A-G-I-C-B-U-Z.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz. We're there when you can't be.
All the Devils Are Here by Bethany McLean and Joe Nocera is a title that could not be more timely. I don't know of anyone whose nest egg didn't suffer some serious cracks these past years. As soon as the financial crisis erupted, the finger-pointing began. Should the blame fall on Wall Street, Main Street, or Pennsylvania Avenue? On greedy traders, misguided regulators, sleazy subprime companies, cowardly legislators, or clueless home buyers? According to McLean and Nocera, two of America's most acclaimed business journalists, the real answer is all of the above and more. Many devils helped bring the current suffering to our economy. And the full story, in all of its complexity and detail, is like the legend of the blind man and the elephant. Almost everyone missed the big picture. Almost no one put all the pieces together. All the Devils Are Here goes back several decades to weave the hidden history of the financial crisis in a way no book has done before. It explores the motivations of everyone from famous CEOs, cabinet secretaries, and politicians to anonymous lenders, borrowers, analysts, and Wall Street traders. It delves into the powerful American mythology of home ownership, and it proves that the crisis ultimately wasn't about finance at all. It was about human nature. Here is All the Devils Are Here, read by Dennis Boutsikaris.
Stan O'Neill wanted to see him. How strange. It was September 2007. The two men hadn't talked in years, certainly not since O'Neill had become CEO of Merrill Lynch in 2002. Back then, John Bright had been one of the company's most powerful risk managers. A former physicist, Bright had been the head of market risk. He reported directly to Merrill's chief financial officer and had access to the board of directors. He specialized in evaluating complex derivatives trades. Everybody knew that John Bright was one of the best risk managers on Wall Street. But slowly, over the years, Bright had been stripped of his authority and, more importantly, his ability to manage Merrill Lynch's risk. First, O'Neill had tapped one of his closest allies to head up risk management, but the man didn't seem to know anything about risk. Then, many of the risk managers were removed from the trading floor. Within the span of 1 year, Bright had lost his access to the directors and was told to report to a newly promoted risk chief who alone would deal with O'Neill's ally. Bright quit in protest, but returned a few months later when Merrill's head of trading pleaded with him to come back to manage risk for some of the trading desks. In July 2006, however, a core group of Merrill traders had been abruptly fired. Most of the replacements refused to speak to Bright or provide him the information he needed to do his job. They got abusive when he asked about risky trades. Eventually, he was exiled to a small office on a different floor, far away from the trading desks. Did Stan O'Neill know any of this history? Bright had no way of knowing. What he did know, however, was that Merrill Lynch was in an awful lot of trouble and that the company was still in denial about it. He had begun to hear rumblings that something wasn't right on the mortgage desk, especially its trading of complex securities backed by subprime mortgages, that is, mortgages made to people with substandard credit. For years, Wall Street had been churning out these securities. Many of them had AAA ratings, meaning they were considered almost as safe as Treasury bonds. No firm had done more of these deals than Merrill Lynch. Calling in a favor from a friend in the finance department, Bright got a hold of a spreadsheet that listed the underlying collateral for one security on Merrill's books, something called a synthetic collateralized debt obligation squared, or synthetic CDO squared. As soon as he looked at it, Bright realized that the collateral, bits and pieces of mortgage loans that had been made by subprime companies, was awful. Many of the mortgages either had already defaulted or would soon default, which meant the security itself was going to tumble in value. The AAA rating was in jeopardy. Merrill was likely to lose tens of millions of dollars on just this one synthetic CDO squared. Bright started calling in more favors. How much of this stuff did Merrill Lynch have on its books? How bad was the rest of the collateral? And when in the world had all this happened? Pretty soon, he had the answers. They were worse than he could possibly have imagined. Merrill Lynch had a staggering $55 billion worth of these securities on its books. They were all backed by subprime mortgages made to a population of Americans who, in all likelihood, would never be able to pay those loans back. More than $40 billion of that exposure had been added in the previous year, after he had been banished from the trading floor. The reckless behavior this implied was just incredible. A few months earlier, two Bear Stearns hedge funds, funds that contained the exact same kind of subprime securities as the ones on Merrill's books, had collapsed. Inside Merrill, there was a growing nervousness, but the leaders of the mortgage desk kept insisting that its losses would be contained. They were going to be less than $100 million, they said. The top brass, including O'Neill, accepted their judgment. Bright knew better. The losses were going to be huge. There was no getting around it. He began to tell everybody he bumped into at Merrill Lynch that the company was going to have to write down billions upon billions of dollars in its subprime-backed securities.
Teenage years in New York City, my guest and pal, Richard Pachter, has written about music, commerce, and culture. And he's worked extensively in the businesses he's covered. Mr. Pachter, my pal, as I said, from our Miami Herald days, began his professional life working for a record distributor and was soon asked to head its radio promotion department. Several months later, he moved to A&M Records, the label founded by musician Herb Alpert. After working with some of the superstar names like Supertramp, Styx, Chuck Mangione, Joan Baez, The Carpenters, Quincy Jones, and more, Richard headed south as A&M's Florida promotion man. He continued his successful tenure with the label for 10 years, working with stellar talents. In parallel to his music biz activities, Richard has been a prolific writer, contributing album and concert reviews to Billboard and other trade publications, plus newspapers and radio. And Richard writes an internationally syndicated book review column for the Miami Herald's Business Monday, which is what we'll focus on today. Readers, I know I've always wondered how book reviewers do their job, and I bet you have too. So let's find out. Welcome, Richard.
Thanks very much, Elaine. I appreciate the invitation.
Well, how did you get your start as a book reviewer?
Well, you know, it's kind of funny. I've been doing reviews of some sort since I was about 13 years old for local newspapers where I grew up. And I always look for an opportunity to inflict my opinion on others because I enjoy doing that. And when I was at the Miami Herald in the creative services department, I noticed that there was a book review section in the Sunday paper, and I sort of started bugging the book review editor to do reviews for her. But as you know, most newspapers have very thin budgets, and I wasn't offering my services on a pro bono basis. So they really weren't able to give me the amount of assignments that I would have preferred. To make a long story slightly shorter, there wasn't any interest from the book review editor for me to do nonfiction stuff. And I have to say, I enjoy novels, I enjoy graphic novels, but I also have a passion for nonfiction. I've always enjoyed reading business books. So I started pitching the business editor to do some business book reviews, and it was just the stars had just lined up in the right place that they liked it. And that was back in September of 2000. So I've been doing reviews for the Herald I'm on my 11th year now.
Wow. How do you select the books you're going to review? There's such a wealth of titles out there. What comes to the top?
Well, you know, it's funny. I don't have a scientific process for it. It's really intuitive, which is a nice way of saying I kind of follow my gut. Sometimes I'm attracted by a title, sometimes a cover, sometimes because I've read the author's earlier stuff. I'm really careful not to read other book reviews. So a lot of times I'll get emails from publicists or authors even, and they'll attach book reviews, and I just don't read them. And I'll even say to them, I don't read reviews of books that I might review. I just don't want to have my opinion colored in any way. Also it's a matter of, like, if I just reviewed a book on sales, then I'm not going to review a sales book the next time. Maybe I'll review something on marketing or branding or human resources, or a particular kind of approach that's different. But I always look for something that would appeal to a general audience. I don't look for technical business-to-business type things that are really heavy-duty involved. I don't do textbooks. I sort of shy away from CEO memoirs because they're really self-serving. In fact, if I can digress, one of the reviews that I got the most reaction from, and I still get reaction on, was the autobiography of Jack Welch that he did.
Man, I knew you were going to say that because I read that book. And when you said what you just said, that's what popped to mind.
Well, that was a good review for me because not only did I find my own voice when I did that review, but I felt that I could sort of say what I wanted to say about something and not be very formal about it. And the response I got was, even though some people were outraged, I got an overwhelming amount of positive response from people because, you know, this guy had a mystique and you know, was thought to be just a god of business. And maybe his accomplishments, you know, warranted that. But I'm reviewing the book, not the person. And the book was just really self-serving and bloated and didn't really tell you how he came upon what skills he had. It was just his ambition and how he pursued things. And, you know, he saw things that other people didn't see. But I'm interested in what I can learn from something. And really, you don't learn very much from this guy other than he's very full of himself.
That's a perfect segue to my next question, which is, how far into a book do you need to get before you get a feel for it, before you know whether the title is going to be fabulous or, dare I say, a dog?
In most cases, I'm very careful with my time because my deadlines are tight. So I can't really waste time reading a book and then like halfway, three quarters of the way through it go, oh, this is terrible. I can't review it. And when I say terrible, I don't mean that the book isn't good. I mean that it's not reviewable. So I'm careful about what I pick because I do value my time. And I, you know, even though I'm a reviewer and a critic, I prefer to like things, not to dislike things. So I try to select books that I think actually that I'm going to like or have value. So, you know, maybe I'm 10 pages through it and I'll get a feel for the book. But whenever possible, I try to read the whole book. Now, I don't always. I sort of use the analogy. It's like a restaurant reviewer. I don't have to eat if I'm reviewing a restaurant, every bite of every meal that's offered on the menu, just enough so I have a sense of what the skill is, what the plot thread is, you know, what's going on, how is it handled, is it nonsense, is it useful, is it fresh, is, you know, that kind of thing. So, you know, I try to read as much as I can, but in a lot of cases I don't. But I don't have to. It's not like a novel where I have to see how it turns out or see what the plot, you know, works out to be. As long as I get enough of the feel of it and I do justice with the material, and honor the author's intentions, then I'm okay.
Tell us about your top business books for 2010. How did you come up with that list?
Very simple. I went through every book that I reviewed in 2010. And wrote down the ones that I thought were worthy, that were really good. And I had about 15 titles. And then I started, you know, winnowing it down a little bit. And when I got to 11, I said, okay, that's it. I can live with that. These are the best ones. It's nice to be neat and have 10, but I made a joke in the review that I was sort of honoring Spinal Tap and going to 11 because it's one more. But really, that's it. Those were the top books that I read. And I said up front, it's a subjective list. Maybe there were books that were better, but I didn't read them. So I can only say what I read. And of those that I reviewed, those were the ones that I thought were best, that I think that you can go back a few years from now and still find them worthwhile. And at the time, they made a very positive impression on me.
What do you say to people who are readers who say, I never read nonfiction, I only read fiction? Do you try and persuade them to pick up a business title?
Well, the thing that I hear the most when I talk to people and they ask me what I do, as far as my book reviews, when I say business books, they go, oh, boring. And I agree with them, frankly, because I get to see all the business books that are out there, and many of them are quite boring. But my job is to find the ones that aren't boring, and not just for their edification, but for my own edification and my own entertainment. Because let's face it, even though a book may be chock full of information, if it's boring, it's not going to go anywhere for me. Sometimes I push the envelope a little bit and I'll call something a business book that someone else may not consider a business book. But to me, commerce, human interaction, all these things are integral parts of our culture. And really, if you're concerned about the culture and interested in the culture, to be a well-rounded person, you have to take those things in, too.
Yeah, thanks, Richard. I agree. We're actually going to preview two of the books that made your top 10 books right after this. But thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me, Elaine.
Bye.
Social media. It's got everyone buzzing these days. But what is it really, and how can you put it to work for you? More than just a passing trend that's hot today, gone tomorrow, social media is marketing that is making a difference for savvy business people who have jumped into the future. Magic Buzz is a new online marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media like Facebook and Twitter together with the viral reach power of YouTube to create the socio-viral effect. Magic Buzz's socio-viral solution provides the measurable value of online advertising that works, affordable, and effective. So get the buzz going for your business. Magic Buzz, with only one Z, because we're never asleep. Visit us at magicbuz.com. For more information or any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
Lynchpin, Are You Indispensable? By Seth Godin topped Richard's list of business books for 2010. There used to be two teams in every workplace, management and labor. Now there's a third team, the linchpins. These people invent, lead regardless of title, make things happen, and generally create order out of chaos. They figure out what to do when there's no rule book. They delight and challenge their peers and their customers. They love their work, pour their best selves into it, and turn each day into a kind of art. Linchpins are the essential building blocks of great organizations. Like the small piece of hardware that keeps a wheel from falling off its axle, they may not be famous, but they're indispensable. And in today's world, they get the best jobs and the most freedom. Now, what about you? Have you ever found a shortcut others have missed? Seen a new way to resolve a conflict? Make connections others couldn't reach? Then you have what it takes to become indispensable. As Godin writes, every day I meet people who have so much to give, but have been bullied enough or frightened enough to hold it back. It's time to stop complying with the system and draw your own map. You have brilliance in you. Your contribution is essential, and the art you create is precious. Only you can do it, and you must. I'm sold. Let's listen as Seth Godin narrates.
So, a guy is riding in the first-class cabin of a train in Spain, and he notices, to his delight, that he's sitting next to Pablo Picasso. Gathering up his courage, he turns to the master and says, "Señor Picasso, you are a great artist, but why is all your art, all modern art, so screwed up? Why don't you paint reality instead of these distortions?" Picasso hesitates for a moment and asks, "So, what do you think reality looks like?" The man grabs his wallet and pulls out a picture of his wife. "Here, like this. It's my wife." Picasso takes the photograph, looks at it, and grins. "Really? She's very small and flat, too." This book is about love and art and change and fear. It's about overcoming a multi-generational conspiracy designed to sap your creativity and restlessness. It's about leading and making a difference, and it's about succeeding. I couldn't have written this book 10 years ago, because 10 years ago, our economy wanted you to fit in. It paid you well to fit in, and it took care of you if you fit in. Now, like it or not, the world wants something different from you. We need to think hard about what reality looks like now. What if you could learn a different way of seeing, a different way of giving, a different way of making a living? And what if you could do that without leaving your job? This is not a program for the wild-haired crazies your company keeps in a corner. It's a program for you, your boss, and your employees, because the best future available to us is a future where you contribute your true self and your best work. Are you up for that? One promise. The world to come, and this program, is neither small nor flat. You are a genius. If a genius is someone with exceptional abilities and the insight to find the non-obvious solution to a problem, you don't need to win a Nobel Prize to be one. A genius looks at something that others are stuck on and gets the world unstuck. So the question is, have you ever done that? Have you ever found a shortcut that others couldn't find? Solved a problem that confounded your family? Seen a way to make something work that wasn't working before? Made a personal connection with someone who was out of reach to everyone else? Even once? No one is a genius all the time. Einstein had trouble finding his house when he walked home from work every day. But all of us are geniuses sometimes. The tragedy is that society, your school, your boss, your government, your family, keeps drumming the genius part out. The problem is that our culture has engaged in a Faustian bargain in which we trade our genius and artistry for stability.
Another title from Richard's Top 10, Drive, The Surprising Truth About What Motivates Us, by Daniel H. Pink. Forget everything you thought you knew about how to motivate people at work, at school, at home. It's wrong. As Daniel H. Pink explains in his new book, the secret to high performance and satisfaction in today's world is the deeply human need to direct our lives, to learn and create new things, and to do better by ourselves and our world. Drawing on four decades of scientific research on human motivation, Pink exposes the mismatch between what science knows and what business does, and how that affects every aspect of our lives. He demonstrates that while the old-fashioned carrot-and-stick approach worked successfully in the 20th century, it's precisely the wrong way to motivate people for today's challenges. In Drive, he reveals the three elements of true motivation: autonomy, the desire to direct our lives, mastery, the urge to get better and better at something that matters, and purpose, the yearning to do what we do in the service of something larger than ourselves. Along the way, Pink takes us to companies enlisting new approaches to motivation and introduces us to scientists and entrepreneurs who are pointing a bold way forward. Drive is bursting with big ideas. Pink's analysis, according to Publishers Weekly, is a new model of motivation offering tremendous insight into our deepest nature. Let's listen as the author narrates.
If the monkeys were rewarded with raisins for solving the puzzles, they'd no doubt perform even better. Yet when Harlow tested that approach, the monkeys actually made more errors and solved the puzzles less frequently. Introduction of food in the present experiment, Harlow wrote, served to disrupt performance, a phenomenon not reported in the literature. Now, this was really odd. In scientific terms, it was akin to rolling a steel ball down an inclined plane to measure its velocity, only to watch the ball float into the air instead. It suggested that our understanding of the gravitational pulls on our behavior was inadequate, that what we thought were fixed laws had plenty of loopholes. Harlow emphasized the strength and persistence of the monkeys' drive to complete the puzzles. Then he noted, "It would appear that this drive may be as basic and strong as the other drives. Furthermore, there is some reason to believe that it can be as efficient in facilitating learning." At the time, however, the prevailing two drives held a tight grip on scientific thinking. So Harlow sounded the alarm. He urged scientists to close down large sections of our theoretical junkyard and offer fresher, more accurate accounts of human behavior. He warned that our explanation of why we did what we did was incomplete. He said that to truly understand the human condition, we had to take account of this third drive. Then he pretty much dropped the whole idea. Rather than battle the establishment and begin offering a more complete view of motivation, Harlow abandoned this contentious line of research and later became famous for studies on the science of affection. His notion of this third drive bounced around the psychological literature, but it remained on the periphery of behavioral science and of our understanding of ourselves. It would be two decades before another scientist picked up the thread that Harlow had so provocatively left on that Wisconsin laboratory table. In the summer of 1969, Edward Deci was a Carnegie Mellon University psychology graduate student in search of a dissertation topic. Deci, who had already earned an MBA from Wharton, was intrigued by motivation, but suspected that scholars and business people had misunderstood it. So, tearing a page from the Harlow playbook, he set out to study the topic with the help of a puzzle. Deci chose the Soma Puzzle Cube, a then-popular Parker Brothers offering that, thanks to YouTube, retain something of a cult following today. The puzzle consists of 7 plastic pieces, 6 comprising 4 1-inch cubes, 1 comprising 3 1-inch cubes. Players can assemble the 7 pieces into a few million possible combinations, from abstract shapes to recognizable objects. For the study, DC divided participants, male and female university students, into an experimental group, what I'll call Group A, and a control group, what I'll call Group B. Each participated in 3 one-hour sessions held on consecutive days. Here's how the sessions worked. Each participant entered a room and sat at a table on top of which were the 7 Soma puzzle pieces, drawings of 3 puzzle configurations, and copies of Time, The New Yorker, and Playboy. Hey, it was 1969. DC sat at the opposite end of the table to explain the instructions and to time performance with the stopwatch. In the first session, members of both groups had to assemble the Soma pieces to replicate the configurations before them. In the second session, they did the same thing with different drawings, only this time DC told Group A they'd be paid $1, the equivalent of nearly $6 today, for every configuration they successfully reproduced. Group B, meanwhile, got new drawings, but no pay. Finally, in the third session, both groups received new drawings and had to reproduce them for no compensation, just as in session one. The twist came midway through each session. After a participant had assembled the Soma puzzle pieces to match 2 of the 3 drawings, DC halted the proceedings. He said that he was going to give them a 4th drawing, but to choose the right one, he needed to feed their completion times into a computer. And this being the late 1960s, when room-straddling mainframes were the norm and desktop PCs were still a decade away, that meant he had to leave for a little while.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. MAGICBUZ.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
Since we're focusing on business this week, let's look at the business of books for a moment. Dan Weiss has been publishing to Gen Y, those folks born roughly between 1982 and 1995, since their infancy in the early 1980s. He first created board books, then novels, and nonfiction for this group of 30 million. Dan is also the parent of 2 20-somethings, and so am I, and knows this crowd inside out. And Dan and I have the scars to prove it. During his long career, Dan published the worldwide hit Sweet Valley High, The Vampire Diaries, and many other popular titles and series for young adults. When this group progressed to high school, then to college, Dan ran SparkNotes.com. Now Dan is publisher at large at St. Martin's Press, building a list of fiction and nonfiction in print and, as you can imagine, electronic editions for the 20-somethings, now to be known as the New Adults. Welcome, Dan, and thanks so much for joining us. I want to jump right into it and ask you, how is this current generation of 20-somethings different, if they are, from previous generations?
Well, there's been a lot of talk about this generation. First of all, they're a very large cohort. They're a very, very big generation of kids, and there are about 30 million of them. It's the baby boom echo. So there were a lot of them. And they are different from previous generations in some remarkable and somewhat contradictory ways. First of all, they grew up in this wonderful period of domestic peace and prosperity for the first 10 or so years of their lives, which was then rudely interrupted by the Clinton impeachment, 9/11, and now the war, and the recession. So for a person who's about 20 or 22 years old, they had an idyllic childhood, which was then kind of ruined by reality setting in when they got to be old enough to understand it when they were in middle school. So they were an odd combination of being very idealistic and optimistic, yet they are cynical and a little bit suspicious of the establishment, like every young generation, but maybe perhaps more so and with better reason than people my age.
Well, back to the books. Are books still really relevant to this generation, especially since, from what I see, they are so plugged in, so digitally literate?
Well, the wonderful thing about books and the wonderful thing about their appeal is when you find one that's great, you devour it no matter how old you are, and you got to tell all your friends. So this group, while the knock has been that they don't read the way older people read, and to some extent that's true, there's some data lately that says that their interest in books is increasing. Moreover, when you see some of the things that have become extraordinarily popular, they're popular because they're appealing to a broader audience, and this audience in particular. There's a book on the list called The Help, and it's been on the list forever. And that's a book that 20-somethings really respond to. Also, the Dragon Tattoo books, those are being read by 20-somethings as well. And at the same time, they're reading books that would be considered young for them. They're reading young adult books. They're reading Harry Potter. So, for example, Twilight is appealing to teens and 20-somethings and moms. So that there are books for them to read, and like everyone else, when one takes off, they glom onto it. But there are lots of other titles that they read that are interesting.
So what are these kids reading now, and what's on your publishing schedule coming up?
Well, I do think that these kids are reading a lot of the same books that are popular everywhere. I think they're reading, you know, Ken Follett, Nora Roberts, and they're reading James Patterson. But they're also reading some of the more interesting women writers. And they're reading the nonfiction that I described, which is often falls into the category of business books. They're reading some inspiration. Women are probably more so than men. They're probably reading some politics, more men than women. And I think that they're probably not that different from the general market. I think that the things that tend to skew a little younger tend to be more thoughtful, slightly more exotic romance-like novels that seem to identify younger heroines, etc. And I think that they tend to run the gamut from very literary to rather commercial. What I plan to publish, in addition to the Sweet Valley Confidential, is I've signed up mostly nonfiction so far, and I'll tell you what they are, because they're cute. We have one book called Working Girl, which is essentially how to have a fabulous life on $30,000 a year. It's a lifestyle guide for the newly employed, and it covers everything from dating etiquette to exercise and health to doing well at a job and some personal finance. And the author is this wonderful young woman who grew up in California with a great voice and great personality and a great platform. Another book that I've signed up is called Dating in the Nude. And it's the follow-up to a book by an author whose first book was called The Naked Roommate, which was a guide for when you enter college. What do you do with a naked roommate if you find out if you have one? And this one called Dating in the Nude is for that crowd that kind of graduated from The Naked Roommate, and it's a dating guide for 20-somethings. Very straightforward, but written in the voice that these kids will understand.
Thank you, Dan. You've really shared some amazing information, and as the parent of two 20-somethings, you are right on. Thank you so much for being with us today.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Here's a title I selected because it's a compelling mix of business and history. In the company town, the industrial Edens and satanic mills that shaped the American economy, author Hardy Green offers a fascinating analysis of the emergence of these company town communities and their role in shaping our economy. Hershey bars, Corning glassware, Kohler bath, Maytag washers, each is a signature product of a company town in which one business, for better or worse, exercised a grip over the population. From the textile mills of Lowell, Mass., to the R&D labs of Corning, New York, America has been uniquely open to the development of the single company community. But rather than adhering to a uniform blueprint, American company towns represent two very different strands of capitalism. One is the socially benign one, a paternalistic utopian ideal that fosters the development of schools, hospitals, parks, and housing for its workers. The other, Exploitationville, focuses only on profits at the expense of employees' well-being. Adeptly distinguishing between these two models, Green offers rich stories about town builders and workers. He vividly describes the origins of America's company towns, the living and working conditions that characterize them, and the violent, sometimes fatal labor confrontations that occurred there. Coupled with profiles of American moguls, the company town is a sweeping tale of how the American economy has grown, changed, and how these urban centers have reflected the best and the worst of American capitalism. L.J. Ganser narrates. Let's listen.
Although one might expect idealistic experiments to fade as industrial society matured, instead, the utopian model has resurfaced again and again. For example, in Pullman, Illinois, the eponymous railroad car maker in the 1880s erected a model town where advanced secular Gothic buildings lined tree-shaded streets. Scotia, California, founded by Pacific Lumber as a rustic forest camp in the 1880s, evolved into a pin-neat, saloon-free Shangri-La amid redwood forests. Workers got low rent, full medical benefits, college scholarships for their kids, and more. Hershey, Pennsylvania, built by chocolate man Milton S. Hershey in the early 1900s, featured electrified, centrally heated homes, a free playground and zoo, and a model school for orphan boys, supported by a foundation that held a majority of his company's stock. At around the same time, companies began erecting such industrial satellite towns as Firestone Park, Ohio, Firestone Tire and Rubber Company, Alcoa, Tennessee, aluminum producer Alcoa, and Kohler Village, Wisconsin, plumbing fixture maker Kohler Company. Such eminent figures as planner Frederick Law Olmsted, Jr. and architect Irving Gill promoted modernist aesthetics in Torrance, California. But ultimately, the successful model would emulate Britain's carefully planned garden cities, with their wide, attractive boulevards and balance of space devoted to parkland, residences, and industry. Evoking pre-industrial villages, such settlements were very different from the grimly functional early company towns, with their strict gridiron of streets and rows of cookie-cutter housing. In general, corporations in this period made a major effort to house their employees. By 1916, 1,000 companies were providing housing for 60,000 employees, roughly 3% of the U.S. population. In the 1930s, government began to play an even greater role in housing development, and New Deal figures questioned the propriety of company towns, particularly in the Southern Textile Belt, running from North Carolina down into Georgia. Nevertheless, company-built utopias continued to sprout, notably during the 1940s, when wartime demand led Henry J. Kaiser to transform the Bayside Village of Richmond, California, into a major shipbuilding area. Kaiser became a pioneer in providing inexpensive, universal health care to his workers with a program that was the forerunner of today's vast Kaiser Permanente health plan. Today, the ideal lives on in such model communities as Columbus, Indiana, home of Cummins Engine, and a veritable museum of modern architecture, according to Smithsonian Magazine, and Corning, New York, home base of the global high-tech corporation Corning, Inc. Such companies openly argue for doing well by doing good. And while a bit of this is intended as public relations and corporate branding, it's hard to deny that there is also an element of genuine good-spiritedness. Most recently, the utopian company town has taken a new form, that of the corporate campus. Both PepsiCo's purchased New York campus and the Googleplex in Mountain View, California, are company town-like in that most all human needs are provided for. Gourmet food, barbershops, laundry service, exercise facilities, and even nap rooms at Google. This velvet glove approach is not without its downside, captured in Douglas Coupland's 1995 novel Microserfs, in which snack-addicted servile geeks willingly labor as 24-hour-a-day vassals of Microsoft Senor Bill Gates. One worker rhapsodizes, "Bill is wise, Bill is kind, Bill is benevolent. Bill, be my friend. Please?" Employees need never leave such a cosseting environment, or ever truly end a working day.
Okay, last item on our agenda. We're going to wrap up this business-themed book report with a smile on our faces. Readers, my next guest, T.M. Shine, is an award-winning journalist who has written on topics as diverse as spending a month in fourth grade at the age of 32, to hunting down an elusive lizard man in the backwoods of South Carolina. A frequent contributor to the Washington Post magazine, he has recently written Nothing Happens Until It Happens to You, a novel without pay, perks, or privileges. It's a wry look at life after the pink slip. Welcome, Terry. So great to have you with us today.
Yeah, I appreciate being here.
Well, you originally set out to write a nonfiction book about your own unemployment. How did it end up being a novel?
The thing was, when I first decided to try to write a book about unemployment, I sent out a proposal pitching a first-person nonfiction account of like the trials and tribulations of my own unemployment because I'd just been laid off. But when I got a response from Random House and Crown Publishing, they said, you know, unemployment's kind of a downer. Would you be willing to turn it into a novel? And I didn't really understand where they were coming from because, like, they're saying on the one hand, a book about real unemployment, too depressing. And a book about make-believe unemployment, oh, people might eat that up. That could be good. So I had no idea where they were coming from, but I immediately said yes. I mean, I'd never written a novel before. I didn't know if I could write a novel. But, you know, I'm unemployed. Of course I'm going to say yes. You know, I told people that, you know, if they could have asked me to turn it into a musical, and I would have said, hold on, I'll get my ukulele, because I was just desperate, you know, at the time. I desperate is the new cool, as far as I'm concerned. I try to convince people of that, because that's the way, when you're unemployed, you're, like, desperate all the time.
Yeah. Well, how much of this book is based on your own life and dealing with your own unemployment?
Well, once I decided to make it a novel, I was adamant about keeping it, you know, grounded in reality, because a lot of times you pick up a novel and it'd be like, you know, two pages in, there's a transvestite strangling a ferret or something, and bears are riding bicycles. But I really wanted to, I didn't want some kind of wacky things. So I wanted to keep it really grounded, so I stuck to, I was adamant about sticking to my own experiences. So the main character kind of became me, the main character, Jeffrey, became me from the very beginning. And then I kind of had to try to fight my way out of that to get out of the bounds of that into more of a novel than just a memoir about my own life.
You know, obviously the subject of unemployment is so touchy. Have you received responses from readers that have surprised you?
Yeah, the thing with that, I mean, I can understand so much about how unemployment is so, it's so frightening. I don't know if you have kids or not, but I kind of compared it to the idea, like, if you lose a child in a department store. I once lost my son in Home Depot, and it only takes like a second, and you're sweating, and your heart is pounding, and you think you're never going to see that child again. And I think that is the way now with people with their jobs. You get called into that human resources office, and you're put on the line there, and they tell you you're terminated, and just immediately you think you're never, ever going to find a good, decent job again. So I understand everyone, you know, being kind of frightened by the whole situation and even being turned off a little bit about a book about unemployment. But I try to keep the idea of it that the main character, the catalyst, is that he loses his job, but then he ends up going on this kind of adventure and sort of an odyssey on his own. And some people, I was surprised, some people told me, used the word that it seemed magical. And I really kind of like that because there is a lot of whimsy to it in a way. It's kind of whimsical. I always like those old TV series like Northern Exposure and shows like that, that kind of made you ponder things and things like that. And also one person, I had one reviewer call me and say that he was amazed at it being about unemployment, that it was, and even not just that it was unemployment, but a book, a humorous book that was able to remain funny throughout. And I was really happy about that, because if it's not funny, it's not going to hold up, because it's such a scary thing to go through.
Yeah. In a recent op-ed piece in the New York Times, you detailed a new phase of unemployment that you're going through, and that's people with jobs who get on your nerves. You want to tell us about that?
Yeah, I think it's the first time the New York Times ever wrote anything advocating tripping people who have jobs. But the idea was that, you know, you go through these phases of, you know, first denial and anger and acceptance. But at one point, after you've been unemployed for a while, you reach this point where you just can't stand people who have jobs anymore. It just starts to get on your nerves. You may go weeks without even thinking about it, but then it's like, you know, everyone, they have their little jobs, they're getting their, you know, their direct deposit checks every week, their 401ks, their medical insurance. And it just really starts to grate on you after a while. I don't think people who have jobs that understand, but I'm sure people who are unemployed go through this phase themselves.
Yep. So what are the next projects you're working on? Or are you continuing to job hunt, or are now you're a famous author and you're just working on new things?
Well, I'm always job hunting, because I'm a big thing about having security and benefits and things like that. So I will continue to job hunt, but I'm also, you know, working on another novel and a comedy show, which I don't like to do. People sometimes read my stuff and say you should do stand-up, and I've always been adverse to it. But I think I might go ahead and do it. I have so much material that I may do it in a way and almost title it, I didn't want to have to do this, because that would kind of be my catchphrase, maybe, that I had to stoop to comedy to try to survive.
Yeah. Well, actually, we're going to be previewing an audio clip from your book next, so our readers and listeners will get a really good taste of it.
Yeah, now that reader, he's a bit of, it almost sounds like a Shakespearean android guy. I don't know where they come from. The book is so grounded, but I hopefully it still comes across.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Terry. It's great speaking with you today.
All right. I really appreciate the time.
All righty. Bye.
Bye.
Reiner has been fired, but he's not crying about it. After being laid off from a mundane job he's held for 18 years, Reiner is in no hurry to get back to work. He quickly dispenses with the nonsense of job counseling and resume building. But he knows in order to make it through these tough economic times, he has no choice but to throw himself at any opportunity that may come his way, no matter how humbling or embarrassing. In Nothing Happens Until It Happens to You, we are witness to a man doing just that, leaving behind the security and predictability of his past to face the realities of his dysfunctional family and a world disinclined to do him any favors. With wry humor and perfect comic timing, this is a story of picking up the pieces and using them to create an entirely new self. As my pal Dave Barry says, there's nothing amusing about getting laid off, except when it's a story told by the brilliant Terry Shine, one of the funniest writers I know. Let's listen as Paul Michael Garcia narrates.
It's just not in me, I know that, but I'm still buoyed by seeing it in others. I feel like I'm soaring and swooping as I approach my true destination, the fax machine. Nicole, whose desk butts up against the copier, spots me briskly walking toward her and says, "It's hard to keep a good man down." "I'm the exception," I say. That's our exchange. I mean, really, that's it, for the past 6 years. Nicole is sweet, but she's one of those people who constantly repeat lines in the realm of working hard or hardly working. It took me 3 years to come up with my comeback, so I really shouldn't talk. Jeffrey, Eileen says, stopping me as I begin to circle back to my desk. What should I do tonight? Regina Spektor at the Cameo, I say without skipping a beat. Cost $28.50. Doors open at 8:30. For more information, visit cameoconcerthall.com. Awesome. I love her, Eileen says. I guess that's my talent. I'm the go-to guy if you want to know what's going on in town, from samba lessons to what ex-sitcom star is appearing at the improv to what time the Coral Gables Health Clinic is scheduling skin cancer screenings. My title, which I received in lieu of a raise 4 years ago, is Universal Calendar Editor. I know, it sounds grand and intergalactic, but it's really pretty mundane. Still, I like being the go-to guy, even if it's only for someone who needs to know where to get their cat spayed on a Tuesday night. Paws City, 1222 Belvedere Road, Margate, the first Tuesday of every month. I stop just before my desk to close the storage closet door, but get a quick, "Hey, leave that open. I'm hiding." Jillian is sitting cross-legged on the corner of my desk, which is not a surprise. I actually keep the area clear for her visits, so she'll always feel welcome. A couple of years back, I put a coffee mug full of Slim Jims in that exact spot, and all the employees began coming by to say hi and make some obligatory small talk. I eventually ran out of meat sticks, and that was the end of my massive popularity, except for Jillian. She continues to stop by periodically, sitting on the end of my desk, crunching on carrot sticks, guzzling Diet Coke, and basically complaining about her day. She is so comfortable with her own beauty, you almost forget about it. But our art department never does. Whenever they need a model on the cheap for a photo illustration, they turn to Jillian. I think I still have a copy of the special food issue, where they have her in thigh-high waders, fly-fishing for Chilean sea bass off a diner's plate in a crowded dockside restaurant. "I think my head is going to explode," she says. As copy editor, Jillian is in charge of correcting all the pronunciation and grammatical errors before they go to print, so I immediately try to envision the shrapnel from the blast, commas boomeranging off the walls, asterisks hurtling through the air and cutting our throats like ninja Death Stars, clouds of periods burst over our cubicles and unleashing a dark, nasty, prickly rain, and everyone covered in Diet Coke. "The sales department is having their big awards dinner tonight," Jillian says. "They have like 6 of the actual awards on display outside the director's office. It's called Excalibur. It's very regal. A miniature sword that looks like the most expensive martini olive skewer you've ever seen embedded in a rock, and it's all encased in a glass cube. Nothing like the slabs of lucite and the Target gift cards the company pawns off on editorial." As I'm talking to Jillian, I see Artie coming toward us with an odd grin on his face. Bearded, disheveled, and wearing shirts that should have been retired in 1984, Artie is one of those beloved characters who endear themselves to everyone by just being themselves. When my 11-year-old niece and a friend visited the office, they simply said, "We like Artie. He reminds us of Jack Black." Artie stops by regularly, too, but it's just part of his M.O.
We certainly took care of business this week, readers. I hope you've enjoyed our journey and picked out a title or two you'd like to pick up. Thanks to Aaron James for our theme music. Girl, you know all about the business of blues. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and I'll see you back here next week for the next chapter of The Book Report. Bye now.